Until recently, Baroness Louise Casey was going to deliver her huge review of English social care by 2028. Then the PM changed, and so did the date. Now the whole shebang is time for next summer. Last week, we looked at what we mean by social care, who gets it, who provides it, and who pays for it, and why our current system is deficient. This week, I want to find out what Louise Casey may be considering, what the alternatives are, how much they'd cost, and who'd pay. Step into the briefing room, and together we'll find out. Joining me again to discuss all this are Thea Stein, Chief Executive of the Nuffield Trust, an independent health and social care think tank, Simon Bottery, who leads independent charity The King's Fund's work on adult social care, and Sir Andrew Dilnot, an economist who was asked by the government back in 2010 to chair a commission to find a fair and sustainable way of funding adult social care in England. Simon Bottery, we looked in the first programme about the history and competencies surrounding social care. Let's look at the now and the future, and particularly about the Louise Casey Commission. Can you tell us what she was actually tasked with doing and by whom she was tasked?
Yeah, she was tasked by the current government with essentially explaining what the current government's manifesto meant, because the current government's manifesto talked about a national care service, and she was asked to say, well, what should that actually mean in practice? What she's actually done, I think, is go even broader than that. I think she's taken this as a very, very broad remit indeed. So she's talking about the health service and benefits as well as social care. But her basic job is to identify what a national care service would mean for England.
OK, and so, Thea, let's go in a bit into what that means. And I mean, firstly, when she talks about interacting with other services, does that mean that when she comes back with recommendations, she's going to make recommendations that go beyond social care and the funding of social care, and which will look at other services too?
Well, none of us know, but it's more than possible that she would do and consider the way in which social care and the NHS interact, and social care and local authority funding interact, and social care and welfare. She has described the need for social care to have a beverage moment, by which she meant a moment of real invention.
Remind us about beverage very briefly.
Okay, so it's basically inventing the NHS. And having an agreement about what is this National Health Service? What do we want? What do we think it is? What do we imagine it to be? I think that's what she expects there to be for social care, a new moment.
Andrew.
There was a marvellous speech that Churchill gave in March 1943, just at the point where it looked as though the Allies were going to win the war in Europe. Mm-hmm. And he talks a lot about Europe, but then he talks about the welfare state. And he says, I've believed 35 years since I first worked with my great mate, William Beveridge, in 1908, introducing labour exchanges, that social insurance brings the magic of averages to the rescue of the millions. And you can count me and my colleagues as staunch supporters of social insurance against every risk for every class of people from the cradle to the grave. And when the social insurance principle was put in place, with the NHS, with a new pension regime in 1948, every part of the welfare state got created except social care. Social care got left with local authorities. It didn't get reformed and rejuvenated for the post-war period. And that's what we desperately need now.
Right. Simon, what has Louise Casey been saying in her speeches about what she feels about the various areas in social care? I mean, has she zeroed in on dementia?
Yeah, she's talked extensively about dementia and also about motor neuron disease. Those are the two things that she's particularly sort of touched on and seen as really critical, and asked Department of Health and Social Care to think about what they're going to do in the short term. And I think that's an example of how she's taking a very broad perspective, actually, because neither with dementia nor with motor neuron disease, this is simply a social care issue. This is an issue which covers the health service, it covers the benefit system, it covers housing. And she's been talking about, you know, not just a national care service, but a national health and care service is the phrase that she's increasingly using.
Thea, it sounds like that what she is doing is not just doing a kind of review which comes up with some recommendations, but she sees herself as beginning a major national conversation in the way that you said Beveridge did, and Andrew reminds us Churchill was interested in.
Yes, and she literally has launched a national conversation, and many people listening may have taken part in that. There's already thousands of comments on the Casey site, which is about a national conversation on social care, where she's asking people to talk about what do they think the problems are, what do they think the solutions are. And so, as in any national conversation, there is a wide range of views. But the important thing is she's inviting people to get involved, to understand what is social care and what do we believe together it should be.
How is that different from what went before? Because you would have thought, I mean, Andrew, I imagine that you tried to have that conversation back in 2011.
Yes, we did. We had stakeholder groups that we met with regularly, the community, individuals. The technology is easier for doing that now than it was all those years ago. But I don't think that means that it's not a good idea to do it now. I think it absolutely is a good idea to do it now. And partly because, as we discussed last week, one of the characteristics of social care is that somehow we don't seem to be able to get the public really to make their voice heard, and that allows politicians off the hook. So I think anything that we can do to build a conversation about social care, what it is, what we need, what we hope for, will help politicians get something over the line.
Simon.
Yeah, I mean, as Andrew says, over a third of the public already think that there is a national care service that's run by the NHS and free at point of use. So you've got an immediate problem that people don't understand the current system very well at all. When they come into contact with it, they're usually pretty shocked to find what they're actually responsible for paying for. And they then struggle and they've not made preparations for that. They've not thought about it in advance.
Is that because people lack the imagination of thinking that this will happen to them? I mean, a kind of classic, it used to be the problem in the pensions area, which was you couldn't get people to think about the pensions until they were old.
There is something in that. We don't want to think that this could happen to us, but we should increasingly be more than aware that we've seen it happen maybe to our parents, we've seen it happen to neighbours. There's an example from Germany where they looked at bringing in individual social insurance, a bit like an individual pension, to guard against this in older age or in an accident, etc. And they found it very difficult. They found that younger people didn't want to engage with that, and they went for much more of a social insurance model where everybody pays in the way that we do for the NHS. So, yeah, we don't want to think about it. We don't want to be aware of it.
Okay. Let's talk now about what it is you think Louise Casey should recommend. Andrew, take us through what the main options, in your view, for reforming social care actually are.
The simplest option is just to move to an NHS-style regime where it's free for everybody. And I think that's something that both Andy Burnham and Louise Casey might find, at least in principle, quite attractive. The challenge with that is cost. And that challenge is two sorts. First of all, just the cost. We don't know exactly what that cost might be, but I suspect it will be in excess of £20 billion a year. And that's not an economically infeasible amount, but politically, it's really pretty challenging.
Can I just ask you a very quick question? Is that £20 billion straight on top of whatever it is we're doing at the moment?
Yes. Right. Yes. So that's one possibility. If you're not going to do that, then you start thinking about what are the things that could be done that would move us towards it? And there have been three structural sorts of suggestions. One is make the existing means-tested system more generous by increasing the amount of money you can have and still be entitled to some means-tested support. And that would help the least well-off and make the whole system more progressive, but would still leave most of the population facing the full effect of the catastrophic risks of, say, a dementia or a severe arthritis or a traumatic injury. The second option, also in our report back in 2011, would be to pool the catastrophic end of the risk. So rather than taking the whole of the risk and pooling that across society, it would be to take the worst risk and set a cap beyond which people would be protected by the state. The third option, which has been talked about a bit and is sort of what we see in Scotland, would be rather than taking the worst end of the risk, starting at the beginning risk and making the first parts of social care free. And the attraction of that is you're then giving something to everybody. The disadvantage of that is it's quite expensive because everybody is entitled and you're still leaving the people with the worst risks largely on their own and facing catastrophe.
Andrew, can we just make this a bit more concrete? Can you take an example of, taking your last case, of somebody whose situation would alter if you took up that policy?
So let's say we've got somebody who has sufficiently bad arthritis that he can't easily get himself out of bed in the morning and can't easily prepare lunch and can't easily get back into bed. So he needs care in his own home. Let's imagine that he's somebody who was a university academic during his working career. And so he's got some pension. He's not wealthy, but he's got some pension. At the moment, he'd be on his own. If you move to free personal care, then somebody like that would start getting some help. The person who wouldn't be so helped by that would be the person with severe dementia who needs to be in a residential care home, who would still largely be on their own, or somebody who's multiple learning disabilities, which mean that they also need to be in residential care. That's kind of the nub of it. So I think there are three big options for major structural reform. Take the whole risk, take the worst risk, or take the first risk. And they come with very different prices. And my hunch is that what Louise Casey is likely to end up with, which is what's been true of most of the major suggestions in the last 30 years, is a mix of all of these. So the Royal Commission went for free personal care. Andy Burnham's own white paper back in 2009 went for something that looked a bit like free personal care, so taking the first part of the risk, but also a cap on the amount of residential care costs you could have. The commission that I chaired in 2011 and which saw legislation 2014 and 2021 has gone on the cap and increasing the floor route.
Right. Theo, let's talk about what you would want to see. I mean, let's imagine for a moment that I am an entirely new health minister and so on. I've been given the job of advising Andy Burnham on what I think should happen. And I think I know. Thea Stein will know the answer to this. Thea, what do you reckon?
Well, I'd say there is no one right answer. Sorry. What there is an answer that's going to be fit for our society, our population now, what will politically be right for us now, and that you can get consensus on, Minister, and that you can get consensus with enough of the public to do. And that's what we see when we look at other countries. So, as you know, Nuffield Trust has done extensive work looking at a range of different countries.
Well, let's look at those other countries. Take us through what other countries have done.
Well, I'm going to take you through all 11. But so, for example, if you look at Germany, that have a system in place where you get a certain amount from the state, then again, you get a certain cap, et cetera, et cetera. You look at Japan that will have a cap on what you can pay monthly. You look at Wales, they have a cap on what you can pay weekly. You've got France, you've got a whole range of different countries that are all doing what Dilnot talked about earlier, which is what are you going to cap? How much are you going to cap? Where is it going to be? What are you going to do in terms of all of this? None of them are necessarily better than the other. They're right for the place they are.
Before we go on any further, I think we'd better dig into the cap, if that's something that you can do with caps and so on, because there's a word we use quite often. Now, I understand the cap to mean if you have to spend beyond this amount, then we will give the extra to you, Simon. Is that what we're talking about?
So a lifetime cap essentially says once you have spent up to a certain point, the state will take over and the state will pay all or some of that extra cost for you. That's my definition of a cap. It's fantastically complicated. In fact, there's a joke that the reason we call it a cap is because it goes over most people's heads. Andrew, I'm sure, will be able to do a better job of explaining it than I did.
Yeah, Andrew, go ahead.
The way I think about a cap is it's the excess in a social insurance policy. So we all have excesses in our insurance. So we pay the first £500 of any car crash. This is the excess in a social insurance policy. So it's a social insurance policy. We're pooling our risk, but we're leaving individuals with responsibility for the first X tens of thousands of pounds.
So if I have private health insurance, they might say, you've got to pay the first 150 quid of whatever it is, and then we'll pay the rest. So that would be an example of a very low cap.
Or even the prescription charge is the same. So in this country, if you're of working age and not on means-tested benefits, then you have to pay the first part of your prescription charge. And although that's a small amount, over your lifetime, that can add up to quite a lot. So it's the same structure as we have for prescription charges.
So the lower the cap, the less you have to pay, the more the state has to pay, and the more and the more of it that you've pooled.
And a cap of zero is an NHS-style model.
Right. OK. And so go back to the question of what people do abroad. What you were saying is, Thea, that different countries that fund out of general taxation set the cap at different levels, in other words, different levels of generosity.
Yes, absolutely. And you can also use the cap to cap, for example, how much you pay into a care home or for your residential fees. You can cap that at a monthly amount. You can cap that at a weekly amount, but they are differentially generous. The most generous system that we found, there may be a more generous that we haven't looked at, is Denmark. But even that is not the NHS. Denmark is paying for everything for everybody apart from accommodation costs in residential care. So you are paying for that yourself.
Okay. Then there are other models, Thea.
Yes. So there are other models where, as we've discussed before, you may get a package of personal care. So in Scotland, everybody could get that contained package of personal care, which is a financial package. In some countries, such as Australia, you get a package of care which includes what they call clinical care, and that may be rehabilitation, etc., and everybody gets it. It's unusual for a country to have everything means tested, which is what we have here. Everything is about your financial situation rather than your need.
Are there any insurance models? In other words, where you do actually make a contribution
yes.
to a specific fund?
Yeah, so Germany does, Japan does. There are a range of countries that do. And this isn't something that though that you do as an individual. This is something that's done through taxation.
Simon?
I mean, the cap, I think we talked about it, is potentially a really important part of a good social care system. But the thing that we need to address in England, and the thing that makes us really unusual, and only really the United States and Wales of developed countries do this, and Thea touched on this, is that we use the means test in a really unusual way. We use the means test to decide whether people get any state support whatsoever, whether they even get into the state-funded system.
That was Andrew's point about the sudden drop-off level.
Absolutely. And what that means is that we've got about 220,000 people who have to pay for all of their social care costs themselves, either in a care home or at home. Most other countries simply do not have that group of people that are having to pay for all of their care costs themselves, because most of them let everybody into a universal system and then use a means test to determine how much is that individual going to have to contribute towards the cost of their individual care. And we have to sort that out. That's the most fundamental
Simon,
thing.
Did these countries at all adopt their systems because they could see what a problem they were going to have?
So I think most countries that have put in place reform have done it for two reasons. One is that they've looked at increasing age and an increasing demand and realised that they have to work out what's a sustainable system going forward. But also they've looked at it and thought what we're doing at the moment actually simply isn't providing the degree of support that individuals need in order to have that, you know, that life that we talked about earlier. And it's a combination of that demographic factors, but also making sure we've got a really decent system in place for them.
Thea?
Yes, I think it's interesting to look at the history of countries and when they start this conversation as a society. Japan's got an interesting history about when they started their conversation about reforming social care. And for them, there was an economic imperative, which was looking at the number of people who, because they were caring for others, were not in the workplace. And actually, the structure of their society meant they wanted to find ways of bringing unpaid carers, and maybe we haven't talked about that workforce enough, really. And they wanted to support unpaid carers, family members, back into the workplace. And so they started to think about different ways of providing better social care. Germany started at the point of reunification, and they were having a lot of conversations about what does it mean for us to be a good society? What does it mean for us to come together and to care collectively for some of our most vulnerable people? In all of these countries as well, I think it's important to note, they also review and reflect on the deals they've got to. In fact, both those countries I just mentioned, Germany and Japan, are currently going through again a reflection on what their deal is.
Is that because they think the deal is inadequate or because they think it's too expensive?
In fact, the deal they've both got, they think, is too expensive at the moment. So they're renegotiating their deal with the public.
Well, that's a very interesting point, Simon, because we are going to have to pay for this. If you were to put a price on the social care system that you, Simon Bottery, would like to see, what would it cost us extra per year, roughly, do you think?
I'm not going to give you an exact number, but for a reason, actually, which is that the model I would introduce, the system I would introduce, is one where everybody does get into the system. There is a universal degree of support, and then people have to contribute to the cost of their individual care. And it's that co-payment that basically decides how much both the individual pays, but it also, by definition, means how much is the state going to pay. And I think we should have that conversation about how much are we able to put in ourselves and how much should the state put in? And that will determine your overall cost.
Okay, have that conversation with me. I'm of an age. There's something I could conceivably face. Tell me how much you think I ought to contribute should I, let's say, have to have residential care for dementia.
Well, let's say you decided that you would have to pay 40% of the cost, for example. If you're in Japan, for example, the maximum you would pay would be 30% of the cost. The minimum might be 10% of the cost. So it's in that sort of range that I think really good systems operate.
Thea's nodding, so I'm going to go to Andrew, who I'm not sure whether he's nodding or not.
I'm not, actually. And the reason I'm not is that my view is that there should be a cap. We use insurance in just about every part of our lives. It's one of the great geniuses of human communities. And I think that, you know, so if both members of a couple need residential care for 10 years, 40% of it could be £800,000. That is a terrifying figure for people. And I think there's almost no argument for it. So I would want absolutely to have a cap on people's liability. The idea of co-payment at lower levels of risk, I'm happy with. But I think the genius of the post-war welfare state in this country and around the world was to take away catastrophic risk from people. Social care is the one place that we still have it, and I think we should get rid of it. So I'm not opposed to co-payment at lower levels of risk, but I'm absolutely committed to the idea that if you or your partner ended up with dementia for 10 years, you would be covered.
Simon.
And that's why I was saying earlier, I think a cap is a really important potential part of any system. So you can absolutely have co-payments and then a cap which sets the maximum amount you pay over your lifetime.
Okay. Thea, are you more likely than Simon was to put a relative annual cost on what it is that you would like Louise Casey to recommend?
I'm going to really disappoint you. No. No, not a number. I mean, a number that we've heard bandied around quite a lot over the last few weeks is 18 billion. But that number was a number that was done a few years ago by the Health Foundation that looked at the cost of bringing those people who were currently at that point paying privately into the state system. So we know that it would already be bigger than that. And we also know that where people have done reforms, there are more people who are in the informal system. I don't think any of us know what that number is. What we've got to do first is look at what do we really want. I mean, we can't cost something until we know what it is that we want and we know what it is the deal is we're prepared to do. But as Andrew said, we definitely want something that doesn't have that catastrophic cliff edge, but we want something that's got all those models within it.
Simon, sometimes people don't know what they want until they know how much it's going to cost them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's absolutely fair. But one of the things Casey Commission is doing is actually having that conversation with the public at the moment, trying to get that sense of what are we willing to pay for? What are we not willing to pay for? And whatever we do, the absolutely critical thing is that it's transparent so that people actually understand both what they're going to be responsible for, but also the level of state funding is transparent. So let's just be really transparent about what I'm going to have to pay and what the state is going to have to pay.
Andrew.
I agree with Thea and Simon's worries about giving a precise number, but I think there is something we can try to put a number on. That's the minimum requirement. And I think the minimum requirement is that we fund the existing means-tested system properly. And in my view, of course, I would say this, wouldn't I, that we set a cap on people's liabilities elsewhere. To fund the existing means-tested system properly over the next few years with the demographic change that we're going to see, I think looks like a bill 5 years from now of at least £4 or £5 billion. And I think then to put a limit on people's catastrophic costs could easily be another £3 to £5 billion. So I think the minimum
per year, Andrew.
Per year, the minimum that the government has to do is probably of the order of £8 to £10 billion. And that compares to a figure that the Health and Social Care Committee came up with a few years ago of £7 billion a year as the minimum level. So that might not be what any of us think is what the ambition should be, but I think it's a minimum level of ambition.
It's still a lot of money, but not as much money as 18 or 25 billion. I want to ask you, all three of you, in various ways, Thea, do you think this time we're going to get it done?
I think what's really positive this time is the fact that we have a prime minister who said, I am going to gamble some of my political capital, some of my political goodwill on this. I want this to be what defines me. I want this to be something important. I think that's exciting and brave, so I'm willing to be optimistic about it.
You mean
it.
Like Tony Blair did over the Good Friday Agreement?
Oh, well, yeah, but or Obama did about affordable healthcare and said, you know what, I'm going to try and go for it. I'm going to use my majority and I'm going to use political goodwill. I'm going to have the conversation that people find so difficult and have brought down so many other politicians. I'm going to have it. So I think we should try and be optimistic about the opportunity we've got here.
Simon.
Well, I agree with Thea. If you're going to work in social care, you have to be an optimist by definition, frankly. But I think also it's really important that we do think this is going to succeed. Because if we go into this saying, oh, well, we've had 22, 23 previous commissions and it's not happened, and so probably it'll happen again on the 24th or whatever, then actually it just makes it much less likely. It creates less pressure on the government to deliver, and it probably means that the public continues to see this as a basket case that is never going to be resolved. This is absolutely resolvable, and there is a real opportunity to do it. So actually, we should absolutely embrace it and expect it to happen.
So you're saying we need the optimism of think tanks and we don't need the pessimism of journalists?
You can put it that way.
If you want to,
fine.
Yes.
Andrew, I think the last word I'm going to go to you, since you've actually been through this mill and then been asked to revisit the mill, and I imagine actually all three of you have been consulted by Louise Casey, actually. But yeah, all nods all around, so you've all talked to Louise Casey. Do you think that we're going to get your minimum system done and maybe even do a bit better?
I hope so. I am genuinely hopeful. A prerequisite is a prime minister who cares, and we clearly have a prime minister who cares. And actually, I think a prime minister who hasn't got very fixed views about what he wants to get done. So I think there's a good chance. You said, David, it's a lot of money. Well, £10 billion is a lot of money, but we should compare it to the much more than £1,000 billion a year that the government spends in total. I think the transformation that we could make to all of our lives for an increase in expenditure of that amount is unparalleled across public policy. So I'm not confident that something will happen, but I'm hopeful, and I think the Prime Minister has put his political credibility absolutely on the line.
And that's all we have time for, I'm afraid. My thanks to Thea Stein, Simon Bottry and Andrew Dilnot. My conclusion? Actually, if I had a conclusion, I'd be doing Louise Casey's job. And just before we go, a quick reminder that if you visit BBC Sounds, you can find our entire back catalogue of programmes, including the one asking whether devolution revolution will help boost the economy, the two exploring how the government is doing on immigration, and the three on how resilient the UK is. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Sally Abrahams and Kirsty Knight. The production coordinator was Siobhan Reid. The sound engineer was James Beard. And the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again oh so soon.
I'm David Dimbleby, and from the History Podcast and BBC Radio 4, this is Invisible Hands, the American Century. It's the story of how, in the ashes of World War II...
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
America rose to become a global superpower.
The United States, whatever our faults may be, is the hope of the world.
And the invisible hands who made it happen.
He's probably the most important person nobody ever heard of.
Listen to Invisible Hands, the American Century. First on BBC Sounds.